So I'll give you some motivation and then some history of monopoles. And I won't talk about anomalies because it's and then we'll have some models and some LHC phenomenology. So, because of the amazing results from the LHC, we still haven't seen SUSY. So, the hierarchy problem traditionally had two solutions, and one, the favored one, didn't show up yet. It's conspicuous in its absence. And the other, as you know, extended technicolor doesn't work. So, maybe, I know a lot of us are working on how to hide supersymmetry at the LHC. I'm working on that. But another way to hide supersymmetry at the LHC is the logical possibility that there is no supersymmetry. And that means we've exhausted our list of solutions of the hierarchy problem. I'm counting extra dimensions as a way of parameterizing technicolor-like theories. Maybe what we need is a new idea. So here's the vision of what a nice new idea might look like. So suppose you had some a fourth generation of fermions that also had magnetic hyperchargers. Unfortunately, you wouldn't be able to calculate the beta functions in such a theory. But either it goes to a conformal fixed point or it doesn't go to a conformal fixed point. So you can imagine that one possibility is that the electric hypercharge continues to run to zero in the infrared. And Dirac told us that magnetic charges go like one over electric charges. So that would mean the magnetic charge is getting strong in the infrared. And this looks like an asymptotically free gauge theory. So you can imagine that in this asymptotically free gauge theory, the things with magnetic charges break chiral symmetry just like they do in QCD. And just like strongly coupled electrons do on the lattice, if you turn up the electric coupling on the lattice, you see chiral symmetry breaking. So these magnetic monopoles could break their chiral symmetries, and if we gauged the global symmetries with the appropriate SE2 left, etc., then we could have something that looks like a technicolor theory, but it certainly doesn't behave exactly like a technicolor theory. So the reasons that technicolor doesn't work may not apply to this type of theory.
Which lattice theory breaks chiral symmetry?
This is 4D. Strongly coupled
V1. 4D non-compact?
I don't know if it's compact or non-compact. You'll have to tell me the difference after the talk. I never remember. But so we certainly believe that strongly coupled gauge theories can break chiral symmetries. So, what do we need to make sense of this vision? We need to know if we can have a consistent theory of massless dions, because we need things that have both electric and magnetic charges. And then, can we arrange chiral symmetry breaking, get electric symmetry breaking, and get all the fermion masses? That's what we'll try to do. So, the history of monopoles starts with J.J. Thomson in 1904, before Dirac. He calculated what happens if you have a charge Q with an electric field and a magnetic charge D with an electric field, a magnetic field. So this is the monopole. And what he found is that if you have the charge sitting here and the magnetic charge sitting here, then there's an extra angular momentum that's just carried by the static field. The magnitude of the angular momentum is the electric charge times the magnetic charge, and it points along this direction between the charge and the monopole. And you can do a little experiment. Imagine pushing down on this charge, assuming this guy is nailed down, and see which direction it moves. And it moves like an angular momentum would move. So it really is an angular momentum there, just classically. Then the standard history of monopoles starts with Dirac. Dirac showed that if you did a Neuronov-Bohm experiment with a charge, well, first he introduced a Dirac string to explain how you could have a monopole in the first place. Then once you have your Dirac string, do a Neuronov-Bohm experiment with the charge. You get to pick up a phase from going around the Dirac string. And that phase, if it's 2 pi, you won't see the Dirac string, which is a good thing because it's just a gauge artifact. And that condition tells you that the electric charge times the magnetic charge has to be an integer over 2. So that means the charge is quantized if there's a monopole somewhere in the universe. And so that's good because we see experimentally charges quantize. So first successful prediction of monopoles. Later, a much older Dirac came back to the theory of monopoles and decided to write down a field theory to describe monopoles. And the first thing you have to do is realize that you can't write the field strength in terms of the vector potential anymore. So what he did was add an extra piece. Here star means an epsilon. So this extra piece is written as a function of the magnetic current K and some extra four vector N, which you can think of as pointing along the Dirac string. So that's an arbitrary four vector. And you can either write it as this inverse of a derivative, so it's a non-local operator, or sort of integral with a weighting function times the magnetic current, where the weighting function satisfies this inverse derivative on a delta function. So just another way of rewriting this non-local thing is another non-local thing. So the only way he found to write down a field theory of monopoles was to introduce this non-local action. And to this day, the string theorist talks about monopoles. They'll wring their hands and say, mutually non-local, and goes back to this. next step was Schwinger. So most people gave up on monopoles once they see that non-local action. It scares most people away, and it should. But Schwinger wasn't scared. He said, we'll just make it even more complicated. We'll introduce things that have both electric and magnetic charges simultaneously, and he called those dions. And then the Dirac quantization condition gets a little more complicated. So we have two particles. So it's the charge of particle 1 times magnetic charge of 2 minus charge of 2 times magnetic charge of 1 that has to be quantized. And there's an associated angular momentum with that more complicated object. The next big breakthrough was Zwanziger. This is the one that nobody knows about, except Joe and Shaba. So Zwanziger said, I'm not going to deal with non-local actions. Let me just write down a local action and see what I need to do to get a theory that has both electric and magnetic charges. So what he did was introduce two vector potentials. One couples to the electric current, one couples to the magnetic current. So A and B are the vector potentials. But we still only want two polarizations for the photon. So we need some complicated kinetic mixing term that reduces it down to just two propagating degrees of freedom. And he figured out how to do that, and it's this complicated looking mess here with an arbitrary four vector N, which we remember from Dirac, we had anyway. So the field strength can be written in terms of the two vector potentials as this big mess. And it's all very lovely, it's local, there's only two propagating degrees for the photon. But now the Lagrangian manifestly is not, well, it's not manifestly Lorentz invariant because it has this four vector N. But what he claimed to show is that this formulation is equivalent to Dirac's formulation when you calculate physical observables. And so you can choose. You can write down a non-local action that's Lorentz invariant, or you can write down a local action that's not Lorentz invariant, and they should have the same predictions.
So the first term in F reduces the standard F for any N?
No, that's, I don't think that's true.
I mean, if I just said the magnetic potential is zero, should it reduce the regular Maxwell union?
This isn't some strange gauge, so. So N, in fact, is a gauge artifact because it's the direction of the Dirac string, so. You'd have to do some crazy gauge transformation. So there are gauges where there is no Dirac string, so if you went to one of those gauges, then it should reduce. So this is obviously much nicer for phenomenologists to deal with. So this is what we're going to be thinking about. Next breakthrough was Tufted-Polyakov. They showed that even if you don't like these funny actions, monopoles exist, at least in principle. If you break some SUN gauge theory with a Higgs, there are solutions with topological numbers. So if you look at a hedgehog solution, we find an object that has a topological number that's equal or proportional to the magnetic charge of the solution if you break down to a U1 subgroup. So in particular, in gap theories, the whole point is to break an SUN or some simple group down to something with a U1, so we get the standard model. And so all those gap theories have to have monopoles in them. So now everyone has to believe in monopoles, because we all believe in guts, because we all believe in supersymmetry. And Tufted Mandelstam pointed out that if you have a magnetically charged condensate, then that would confine electric charges, and vice versa, if you have electrically charged condensates, it confines magnetic charges. We're going to use that later too. Then, this is the big one, the most important thing about monopoles. Rubikov and Callan showed that if you just write down the low energy effective theory of a monopole and some charged fermions, that theory is not unitary. And you can even see at the classical level that there's some problem. So say I have an electron scattering up a monopole. I have some angular momentum of the problem. It's E times G, and it points from the charge to the magnetic charge. But if it's a head-on collision, then B cross B and B cross E are zero. So there's no forces on these guys from electromagnetism. So classically, you'd say they just go right through each other. So then we'd end up with this final state where they've gone through each other. But now this angular momentum has flipped. And so we haven't conserved angular momentum. So this theory is sick as it stands. What they found was that if you look at the quantum theory, you can convince yourself that there are some new unsuppressed contact interactions between the fermions and the monopoles, Rubikov-Callan interactions. And further, that because you can do the scattering at arbitrarily low energies, that tells you that these contact interactions aren't suppressed. They have to be marginal interactions, which is kind of surprising. Just if you did the dimensional counting in your head, you would think that it's not going to work. So you have two electrons and then two other guys. Sounds like it's more than dimension four. So you have about 20 minutes to think of how you violated the decoupling theorem, or how you didn't violate the decoupling theorem and satisfied these guys' requirements. So the date on this was like 1982, and then by 1983, everyone was all abuzz. Joe was writing papers about this. And then, unfortunately, string theory came along and distracted everyone from monopoles until 94. Then our friends came along and said, there's some really cool things you can do with n=2. So if you have an n=2 gauge theory, you can solve the low energy effective theory exactly. Turns out it all comes down to understanding some elliptic curve that describes a torus. If we move around the moduli space of this gauge theory, this torus changes its shape, and at certain places, one of the cycles along the torus degenerates. And at exactly that point, there's a monopole, and there's a corresponding point where there's a dyon. And not only is there a monopole, it becomes massless at this point, and that's why this is the plot of the electric gauge coupling. So the gauge coupling is blowing up because there's a massless monopole running in the loops, making the magnetic charge go to zero, which means the electric charge is diverging. So that means that we have theories that have massless fermionic monopoles. Massless fermionic monopoles. So it's not crazy because these guys says it's okay. Even better, Argyris and Douglas showed that if you look at slightly more complicated theories, you can arrange it so the point where the monopole is massless and the point where the dyon is massless can sit on top of each other. So that means they believe that these theories where they sit on the same point are conformal field theories, but there are theories that have massless electric and magnetically charged fermions interacting in the same theory. And then we wring our hands and say mutually non-local. Or we remember Zwanziger and say, well, we'll just use Zwanziger's action and we still won't be that happy because one coupling is the inverse of the other, so it's very hard to arrange for them both to be perturbative at the same time unless some people have argued that if alpha was a half, then the other alpha is a half, and you could have a slowly convergent perturbation theory, maybe. But let's just take this idea and run with it. So we'll write down fourth generation has the standard SU3 cross SU2 cross hybrid charge assignments for a normal generation. We're going to have an extra right-handed neutrino, and we're going to add a magnetic charge. So this should be a perfectly fine effective theory, if only we could figure out what it does. But first, we'd have to understand how do we choose the magnetic charges of these guys. So if we want to have a theory of electric symmetry breaking, we're going to want the quark to get to condense, the left-handed quark to condense with the right-handed quarks, and the lepton to condense with the right-handed guys. So we need them to be vector-like with respect to the magnetic charge. Otherwise, they won't do their job of breaking electroweak symmetry for us. So that's, again, reminiscent from Technicolor. And then, if we look at the Dirac charge quantization condition, we know that the product of any of the charges with magnetic charges appropriately put together has to give you some integer times a half. So if I have some hypercharges that are a sixth, it wouldn't be too surprising if the smallest magnetic charge was 3, because 3 times a 6 is a half. So the charge quantization sort of fixes the magnitude. And the thing that we have to explain is why this guy is minus 3 times that guy. That was some particular choice we made. And the reason is that the same reason that this is minus 3 times this guy. It's anomaly cancellation. So we need to understand anomalies of magnetic charges.
So, can I ask a dumb question?
Yeah.
These theories don't have, at least not obviously, a classical limit, right? Because you said one or the other charge blows up at large distances.
Well.
So, or at least these elementary particles you're talking about don't have. Don't exist classically.
Well, what I care about, I think, Joe knows more about this than me, but if we take this Lagrangian that von Zeiger provided us, put it in a path integral, simulate it on the lattice, there's some particular formulation for how to do this on the lattice that gives us some answer for the quantum theory. So if we could calculate in the quantum theory, I don't know if I care about what the classical theory does. I mean, this charge quantization.
It's worth asking. I mean, do you see it as it's confining in some way?
I don't think it's confining, but I can't prove that. What we're hoping is that it'll break chiral symmetries for us, but we haven't shown that either. What we're going to do is sort of like if you think back to the talks we all sat through in the 80s, some of us. You write down a Technicolor theory, you assume it does what it wants, what we want it to do, break electric symmetry and see what the consequences are, and then make predictions that can be tested. And then when they don't see those predictions, then we don't really care that we didn't actually calculate anything. If they do see the predictions, then we'll start to worry about how to calculate this theory. I think that's the Technicolor paradigm.
Do you have masses for the model? Do you have what you put in as masses from there?
No masses. So what we want is a theory that has fewer parameters than the standard model. So these masses, if it breaks chiral symmetry, that will generate masses for them dynamically, like technofermions do. So anomalies. So we can take von Zeiger's Lagrangian, and there's a beautiful story using SL2Z transformations that allows you to take whatever dion you have, do an SL2Z transformation, which is like electric magnetic duality, and map it to something that just has electric charge. Calculate the anomaly, then map it back to the basis that you want. And you can read about that there. It's all beautiful. It's lots of fancy words. But we're just going to take the hand-waving approach that gives the same answer. So if I wanted to calculate the anomaly, it's just some triangle diagram of a fermion. The fermions, I didn't even write them, but they're inside these currents, so there's a psi bar, sigma bar mu psi. So the fermions are just fermions, like any other fermions. And they have gauge couplings, like any other gauge couplings. So when I calculate this triangle anomaly, the things inside the loop are exactly the same as any other anomaly. The funny stuff is all in the photon propagator, but I don't see that inside these loops because these guys are external. So the hand-waving argument says you should just treat this extra magnetic charge like an extra U1, and the SL2Z story gives exactly the same answer. So that's the answer. So just have to check all the mixed anomalies. So there's a charge cubed anomaly that we're familiar with. There's a magnetic charge cubed anomaly. There's a magnetic charge squared charge. Charge squared magnetic charge. All the mixed anomalies you would have if you just said this was an extra U1. And this toy model cancels all these anomalies. So another non-trivial check. Some of you are not surprised because you know that the standard model has another U1 that you could have gauged called V minus L, and these are proportional to V minus L. So it had to work. Now we have our model. So the first thing we can check is the Dirac relation that relates the magnetic charge to the alpha hypercharge. It would tell us that alpha magnetic is 98, a little bit bigger than you might have wanted. 4 pi would have been nice. But this is the toy model, so I've misdirected you. We're going to throw this model away in a few minutes after we see why it is completely useless. So don't worry about the 98 yet. So to show you why it's useless, let's think about how Technicolor failed. So how did Technicolor fail? The big failure of Technicolor is that it explains the W and Z masses wonderfully, but it can't explain quark and lepton masses. So traditionally what you do is add some extended Technicolor gauge interactions. They turn ordinary fermions into technofermions. So you get some new 4 fermion operators suppressed by 1 over the mass squared of the gauge boson. Then when the technofermions get strongly interacting in the infrared, these guys condense and break the chiral symmetry, so I can close this off with some dynamical mass insertion, and I feed down a mass for a quark. The problem is that whenever I introduce those ETC interactions to get the masses, I also get things like this that give me flavor-changing neutral currents that are suppressed by 1 over m squared. And we want these to be very, very small, and in the case of the top quark, we want them not to be small. And then you compare. The same thing has to be simultaneously very, very small and not small, and you see it doesn't work. If you compare that to the standard model, the brilliant success of the standard model is that the masses come through a marginal interaction. So if I put in some crazy flavor physics at some high scale, I only have some logarithmic sensitivity to that high scale. But in the flavor-changing neutral currents, I'm suppressed by 1 over some mass squared. So I can make this big without destroying my U-chiral couplings. So the standard model is brilliant. Extended Technicolor is a dismal failure. So we just need to reproduce that success. And how are we going to do that? We're going to use Rubikov and Callan. They told us that there are new unsuppressed interactions. So look at the simplest case with a scalar monopole. If I scatter a right-handed electron off this monopole, I have some angular momentum, and Q is minus 1 and G is a half with a minimal magnetic charge. So this is minus a half, but I have a spin of this electron, which is plus a half. And in the final state, the velocity of the electron flips. I have a left-handed electron So the spin flips and the angular momentum flips because they went through each other. So Rubikov and Callan say we need this interaction to make this unitary. So we have these new operators. Can we use them for our favorite new theory? So if these monopoles had been fermions, like we want, and they broke their chiral symmetries, then I could close off this line and feed down a mass to the electron. So usually Marcus is supposed to stand up and say, I don't understand this Rubikov-Callan stuff. It doesn't make any sense. And so I put this slide in for him. So what's going on is that classically we have our standard R cross P angular momentum and this new J.J. Thomson angular momentum from the charge in the monopole. If we look at the square of that angular momentum, it neatly splits into what we usually think of as the angular momentum plus this new piece. Now, Wu and Yang showed that when you try to quantize this kind of system, to get the correct angular, this combination satisfies the correct commutation relations for an angular momentum, but R cross P does not. So you have to use this as the angular momentum to get the right commutation relations, and then when you quantize it, you find that this L squared is quantized as L times L plus 1, and the minimal value of L is Q times G. So another way of saying it is that when you learn in quantum mechanics that you can't write spherical harmonics for half integer angular momenta, they were lying to you, because this will allow you to do that. You choose Q times G to be half integer. And the trick is that these monopole harmonics are not functions, they're sections. That's also what allows you to pick a gauge where there's no Dirac string if you make the gauge field a section instead of a function. So if we look at the square of the Dirac equation, here's our usual gauge field and coupling to the field string through the spin. And after massaging, we get something like this. We find there's a kinetic term, there's a centrifugal barrier. But now the centrifugal barrier depends on L squared minus Q squared U squared, because this is R cross P squared plus this, and only R cross P is going to contribute to the centrifugal barrier. And there's a dipole moment of our charged fermion, which couples to the magnetic field of the monopole. And so when we put in what the magnetic field of the monopole is, it's G times 1 over R squared. Now we see that if we choose L is Q times G, then the L squared cancels this. And then we have Q times G minus Q times G for the right orientation of the spin. So for one helicity, we can go all the way into the monopole. But then that helicity can't come back out. So that's why we need the Rubikov-Callan interaction. Otherwise, we'd have dropped left-handed electrons in, and they wouldn't come out. And then we wouldn't have a unitary theory. So we really believe that Rubikov and Callan know what they're talking about. So let's apply it to our toy model and see why the toy model fails. So we need to generate some interaction that lets a top quark get a mass from one of our monopoles. So in that model, we can just write down, say a top quark goes with an up-type, a quark-type monopole. Putting in the numbers in the table, we see the angular momentum in the electromagnetic field is 2. Because it's a fermion, now we have the total spin is 1. And in the final state, these guys flip around and we get some crazy angular momentum minus a half, and the spin is flipped. So this guy flipped, but the J in the electromagnetic field didn't flip, so it doesn't work. You don't get a top quark mass. And you can fail. You can try other combinations there that we tried. Right with left. You can try left with left. It gets worse because we don't have any spin then. So the model doesn't give us a top quark mass. So it's as bad as Technicolor. But the reason, if you dig into it, why it's failing is that the magnetic charges are too big. those magnetic charges smaller, then we would get the operators we want. But Dirac told us we had a minimum size. But we know from Gut days that there are more clever monopoles that also have chromomagnetic charges. They are allowed to have smaller magnetic EM charges. So in particular, we can think about, we're going to think about monopoles that have both color and SE2 left magnetic charges in addition to magnetic hypercharges. So then when we break to electromagnetism, there'll be a corresponding Q magnetic that is made out of the SE2 magnetic charge and the magnetic hypercharge. So we're going to look at monopoles that in a particular gauge, we can choose them to have a SE2 magnetic gauge field that goes along the 3 direction and a color magnetic gauge field that goes along the 8 direction. And then our charge quantization condition is that this combination of color and color magnetic, SE2 and SE2 magnetic hypercharge and magnetic hypercharge is quantized.
The magnetic dual of SE2 is SE2 mod Z2?
Well, of the whole thing, it's SE3 cross SE2 cross E1 mod Z6, I believe.
Does that mod Zn do anything?
It tells you that you're allowed to do these games. As far as I can tell, that's the only thing that it does. So here's our charge quantization condition, and here's how we make the ordinary photon out of an SE2 left gauge boson and a hypercharge gauge boson. So if we choose in our model that the magnetic charge of the SE2 is 1, then because of this relation, this quantization condition just reduces to the usual one you see in Preskill's review. But there's a color piece and a E and M piece. So we can think about the charge quantization works above and below the electroweak symmetry breaking scale. If it didn't, then something would be pretty screwy. So the improved model of mod Z6 looks like this. Now we've divided all our magnetic charge, magnetic hypercharges by this used to be 3, now it's 1/2. And there's a superscript M over here, these guys, and they also have magnetic, non-abelian magnetic charges. And now our alpha is, magnetic is only 32, much better than 98. So that's only 3 times 4 pi. Anyway, now we can check the Rubikov-Cowan operators. Is that something that is reliable? So, I think this is a typo. This should be an N. Why is this here? So the claim is that with these new charges, the spin, if we look at the right combination, the spin will flip and the angular momentum flips. So now, the big hooray. So, you guys have to trust my algebra, I guess. You can check it after the talk.
So John?
Yes?
The story you told us about why Rubikov-Cowan implies marginal operators. Mm-hmm. Is that something you can check at like an Argyris Douglas fixed point where maybe you have more control over operator dimensions?
I would hope that you could check it, but no one understands where those Rubikov-Cowan operators are in their construction.
But even if you don't see that the operator is there in the Lagrangian, can you calculate its dimension? I mean, you can just... You know what the operator is, right? I'm wondering if you have control over
it. I don't know what the operator is in that case.
One.
Well, they claim they have a low energy effective theory where they have light monopoles. So You should be able to write down something that satisfies.
Is it a chiral operator or not in the supersymmetric forms? I guess it's not.
I don't think it is.
It's not. It's...
In particular, there should be four fermion operators.
So you might not have much control anymore.
Yes. And there are other things that are screwy about Parcheris Douglas. If you calculate anomalies, they don't seem to work according to your rod. So there's something yet to be understood about Parcheris Douglas. So what we can do is, given the charges in the model, we can write down what the scattering amplitudes look like. And from that, we should, in principle, be able to infer what the operators look like in this case. So we have operators that involve the right-handed neutrino monopole and an uptight quark. And they're combined in a spin-like combination. And then to take account of the angular momentum in the electromagnetic field, we need some polarization vector that accounts for that. This is in yet another paper by Zwanziger. I don't know if anyone's read that one. Travis read it. So what you see is that this polarization vector is simple in the frame where the monopole is at rest, but you have to boost it to an arbitrary frame, and then it's a horrible mess, and it depends on some arbitrary four-vector again, which is not too surprising since every time we write down a Lagrangian for the monopoles, that four-vector appears. The nice thing is that when you square these amplitudes, the dependence on the four vector goes away. So even though the amplitudes are not gauge invariant, the probabilities are gauge invariant. So we get operators that can feed down the top quark mass, and assuming we believe the story that they're marginal, we understand why the top quark is allowed to be heavy, which was a failure of Technicolor. We couldn't make the top quark heavy and suppress Lagrange change in neutral currents. The hand-waving understanding is that if I look at, we're normalizing this operator, I can exchange a photon from this ordinary fermion with this monopole. I get an E times 1 over E. So inside this operator, ordinary fermions behave like they're strongly coupled. So your naive estimate of the dimension of this operator would be sadly mistaken. It doesn't tell you why it's marginal, though. Well, that's what Rubikov and Callan told us has to be the case, because we have to satisfy unitarity arbitrarily low energies. And they wouldn't lie to us much. We also find that we get operators that couple just the monopoles themselves in various combinations. And these guys are good because they break a lot of the chiral symmetries of the model. Without these operators, we'd have a whole bunch of massless Goldstone bosons, which we haven't seen. So it's nice that there's a reason why we haven't seen them yet.
So if I have a multiple, if I use this Lubakov-Callan operator twice and have a multiple in the loop, I can generate still more. Would that be a scale of this
multiple? I don't think we know how to calculate that.
Like CMC is okay because we can't calculate.
Hey. You know it's a higher dimension operator, right?
Yeah. I mean, then if the external guys are just ordinary fermions, it's a dimension 6. Yeah. So you know it's suppressed. The question is what it's suppressed by. Yeah.
Maybe you would think it's a curve schedule regular scale, which is bad.
I didn't promise to solve this theory. But if we're assuming that it breaks chiral symmetries, like a strongly coupled theory likes to, then because the quark monopoles have a different magnetic charge, the global symmetry is not the full SU8. It's SU6 plus SU6 plus SU2 plus SU2 for the leptons, and some U1s. And if they break the way we expect them to break, the leptons pair up with the leptons, and we break the diagonal subgroups of those guys. And so with those Rubikov-Kalman operators that we found, that leaves three exact Mambu-Goldstone bosons. We need those because we can gauge an SE2 left. And there's 38 pseudo-Mambu-Goldstone bosons. So these guys we've already seen. They're the longitudinal W and Z. Now we need to look for these guys.
So, Jim, do you have some very concrete prediction about the relation, for example, of some other Z scale versus the electroweak scale? Because suppose you define what is the correct accompanying to trigger fermion condensation. Suppose you want to require alpha equals to 4 pi, and then you take care of the Romney, and then you will know that at what scale, exactly what scale, you will generate.
We can't even calculate the running in this theory, so we can't do anything like that.
But in principle, there should be one scale, should be related to.
Yes, in principle, if we put it on the lattice, we can get the scale.
I'm just curious that whether that scale disagree with the electric scale or not.
Which scale would this be?
The scale from some non-perturbative calculation.
We'll know that when someone does a non-perturbative calculation, but...
But I'm saying you only have one chance. You only have one chance to get
yes,
it correct,
this is,
right? But you have
in principle, this is a very predictive model.
That's correct.
Fewer parameters than the standard model. So if we could calculate anything, we could rule it out tomorrow. So... what we can calculate is, assuming it breaks chiral symmetry, then there's a definite prediction. We have all these pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone bosons and the ordinary Goldstone bosons. And so we should just write down the chiral Grandjean, including the effects of those Rubikov-Kalman operators. So here's the ordinary kinetic terms. There's one for the lepton sector, one for the quark sector. Then there's one that feeds down the mass to the up-type sector, which allows us to get a top quark. And in principle, there's two different scales, F, because these guys are different magnetic representations. So there's no reason why they should have the same F pi. And lastly, there's a term that couples the two sectors. So there were those extra Rubikov-Kalman operators coupled leptonic monopoles to quark-like monopoles. So there's an operator like this. If you remember your QCD lore, if you think of, say, this is the Higgs, and this is the pion of QCD, this is what gives you feeds down the quark masses to the chiral Lagrangian. Now here, sigma L, because it's has a bigger magnetic charge, presumably has a bigger F, so it is mostly the thing that plays the role of the Goldstone bosons getting with some small mixture of this. And then there was a term that coupled these together, so it also feeds down what would look like a current mass through the quark monopoles. From their perspective, they're getting a mass from some external sector. So these guys don't have to be light anymore because they have these effective current masses. And if we knew what A was, then we could predict what those pseudo-Goldstone boson masses would be. Another chance for a lattice gauge theorist to tell us something. So, not knowing what A is, it interpolates from something that looks like a pion to something that looks like an eta of charmonium. That's the limit where the current quark masses are much bigger than the dynamical scale. And then we can start calculating how these would show up. So, if we, just a simple example, if we look at the neutral Goldstone boson, I'm going to finish early. That's good news. We look at the neutral Goldstone boson up here. Anomaly, the usual anomaly would tell you that you should be able to decay to two photons, just like the pi naught. And you might think that this is a very big width because now these guys have magnetic charges. But the magnetic charges are isospin invariant. They're the same for up and down. And so you can't have two magnetic charges because that would be a singlet state in the flavor, where this is a triplet. So you need at least one electric charge to appear for this decay to go through. And that means there's an alpha electric times an alpha magnetic. And so that's a quarter, according to Dirac. So this is work in progress. So there's some factors of two that are missing. But that means the alpha dependence cancels here. So instead of getting a very big width, you get something that's still small, but not as small as it would have been for a QCD guy. So now we just have to wait for our LHC friends to find a bump in diphotons, and then we'll know the mass of the pseudo-Goldstone boson.
Do you know the branching fraction?
So there should also be, there's also a 5-point guy in the anomaly in the West Amino term. So we need to calculate one electric charge and four magnetic charges and put in the phase space for four body. But I've never done a four body phase space calculation, but in principle, we can do that. So today, I don't know. So conclusions, monopoles are still fascinating after all these years. Monopoles in principle can break electric symmetry and give the top quark a large mass. And monopole phenomenology has lots of open questions, so there's 2 weeks left in the workshop. Get to work. Thanks.
Situation as a kind of inspiration for the analysis, and on the other hand, we know that just at observed Douglas point, we have zero magnetic condensate. Monopole condensate vanishes exactly at observed Douglas point. The same for fundamental condensate. So this is a little bit against this logic. So,
well, and
this is,
I mean, when you add
not the perturbative phenomenon, the vanishing of magnetic monopole condensate at Argyris Douglas point. It's not.
But when you add perturbations like Suzy breaking,
exactly. So we start with an equals two, adds some small perturbation, and it turns out that just at Argyris Douglas point we have vanishing monopole condensate. It's exact statement.
But in that case, it's a conformal field theory. So the question is this a conformal field theory? That we don't know.
You calculated the scattering amplitudes associated with the Kalin-Rubikoff effect.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to make any assumptions about the masses of particles?
So the Kalin-Rubikoff is calculated in the limit that the monopoles are infinitely heavy. And part of our work in progress is that we believe that that still works when you include a finite mass for the monopole, as long as the monopoles are fermionic. Which, in this model, they are. So. But I don't think anyone addressed that back in the gut days, as far as I know. They had scalar monopoles, so there was something fine going on. Okay, well, let's thank the speaker.